So, in the second half of the 1980s, I lived mainly in India. And quite a bit of that time I lived in, I think you can call it, the megapolis of Bombay, now called Mumbai, but it was definitely Bombay in those days. And some of that time I lived as an Anagarika. I was Dharmachari, but I was a Dharmachari Anagarika. I wore yellow robes, I was celibate, and I was working full-time for the Dharma. I think just about every day of the week there was some sort of Dharma activity somewhere or other. There was a talk in a slum or a chul or tenement block or something like that. There was classes, there was chapter meetings, there was mitra study, all those things. And there was a whole team of us, me with Indian order members and mitras, who would be going to different parts of Bombay to teach the Dharma. And sometimes we'd go on tour. We'd go on a big Dharma lecture tour to places around Bombay. And on a few occasions, we went down the coastal strip of Maharashtra. So that's just north of Goa, which some of you might know. Very, very beautiful, picturesque part of India. I don't know if it's still like that, but particularly the southernmost part of what's known as the Konkan area, an area called, a district called Sindhudurga. Extremely beautiful, so unspoilt, and really, really picturesque. It was really lovely place to travel around. But we were there to teach the Dharma in these different towns and villages and so on. And at the last of these, on the last part of our tour in there, in the south of this strip, a young man came up to Bodhi Sen, who was my interpreter, an Indian order member named Bodhi Sen. And he asked us if we would come to Goa, if we'd come after this the next day to the capital city of Goa, a place called Panjim, to give a Dharma talk. He told us there were lots of Buddhists in Goa, which I hadn't realised. I thought Goa was mostly Christian and Hindu, but he said, no, there's lots of Buddhist people there. And I think, he said, it would be really good if you came and gave a Dharma talk in the city of Panjim. And So, the great thing was, Bodhi Sen and I, we knew we didn't have much going on back in Bombay. I mean, we could have gone back and done stuff there, but actually we were free. So we decided, yeah, okay, we'll come. Wonderful feeling, we didn't have to get Philofax out that people had in those days or, anything like that. We could just go and do this talk. Wonderful thing about being in India in those days. So the next day we jumped on the rickety state transport bus, went down the coast, went from largely Hindu Sindhudurga with its low-slung village temples into predominantly Christian Goa. So instead of temples and chai shops, it was churches and bars. Very different kind of world. But almost immediately, as you were across the border, it felt like you were in a different country. And for us, it wasn't going, we weren't going to be hanging around the hippie beach spots or anything like that. We weren't interested in that. We were there to teach the Dharma. And we gave a talk on the Dharma in the town hall cum library, right in the centre of Panjim. So it was a really public place that we were in. And there was a really big crowd there at the hall. This young man had really roused people, got people together, and there was a lot of people. The word had gone around that people were coming. No doubt it helped the fact that I was a Firangi, that I was a foreigner, and I was wearing yellow robes. So the place was packed. And I gave my talk with Bodhi Sen with me, because he was an intrinsic part of the talk, my interpreter, improver in many ways, on this stage beneath a great big image of the goddess Saraswati. This image of Saraswati seated on a goose. A goose is a very important symbol in Indian culture, in spiritual culture. It's not a swan. It's often translated as a swan, but Hansa is goose. And this beautiful, mature-ish woman image in a red sari playing her veena. That's who I was speaking under, the Devi Saraswati. And the goddess of learning, the goddess of culture, the goddess of the arts and the sciences, the goddess of knowledge, worshipped by Hindu students to aid them in the passing of examinations. You often see, or you used to see it, and if it's still the case, Saraswati is on exercise books and things like that, just to help people pass exams. People often go and do Saraswati puja before they take their exams. Now, usually I'd be a little uneasy giving a talk beneath a Hindu image. It wasn't a temple. The image was there, you know, because it was a sort of town hall or library. But I felt a little bit uneasy because for Buddhists, these Hindu images are really symbols of oppression. They're not just quaint, orientalist, exotic imagery, which, people in the West can like. These images symbolise the oppression of people who come from what's called these days a Dalit background. They're not neutral for people. But I felt a little bit more comfortable with giving the talk with Saraswati present, because Saraswati's first mention in Indian literature is in a Buddhist text. It's actually in the Sutra of Golden Light. And I knew that because Sangharakshita had told me that, had told us that in his lecture on Buddhism culture in the Sutra of Golden Light lecture series. He was told that by one of the foremost Indian scholars and philosophers, Surendranath Dasgupta, that Saraswati first appears in a Buddhist text. So I felt sort of okay with Saraswati there as we gave the talk. She, in the Sutra of Golden Light, promises to protect and support the Sutra, or particularly the person who communicates the Sutra. I'll say something about that later. Perhaps Saraswati granted eloquence to Bodhisen and myself as we spoke, because we had a really positive response to the lecture. It was a really good evening. It was one of those evenings, maybe because we were very conscious that we were the first people from Tri Ratna, sounding the drum of the Dharma in Goa. You know, we were really sort of excited by that, so we were a bit on fire. Maybe it was a particularly receptive group of people. Maybe it was Saraswati. I don't know. But on the basis of that lecture, and going back there later, in time, a centre started in Goa. I presume it's still going, the centre in Goa, yes. Yeah. So that's good to hear. And there's social work there as well. So it's really lovely to to think that perhaps Bodhisen and I had a part in that, sowed a seed there all those years ago. So I couldn't help but reminisce when thinking about this talk, in which we'll look at Saraswati's promises to the Buddha in relation to the Sutra of Golden Light. But before doing that, before I get to that, I want to just reflect a little on how it was that I came to be giving a talk beneath an image of Saraswati in Panjim all those years ago with Bodhisen. Of course, there are all sorts of conditions and connections and links, but the most important of all was my meeting with Sangharakshita and meeting his disciples when I came along to the movement back in 1974, especially meeting an older member named Lokamitra. Without meeting Sangharakshita and without meeting Lokamitra, I doubt whether would have even gone to India in the first place. I certainly wouldn't have gone to India to teach the Dharma. I could also say, and I don't think this is far-fetched, that the Sutra of Golden Light played a part in all that as well, in me being in India. And especially Sangharakshita's lecture series given in the late 1970s at Hampstead Town Hall called Transformation of Life and World in the Sutra of Golden Light. That lecture series had a very, very big impact on the order and the movement. It really did. I mean, it might seem a bit strange to you that, a lecture series given all those years ago could have such a big effect, but it wasn't just the words that Sangharakshita was saying, it wasn't just the ideas, it wasn't just the incredible imagery that he was bringing. It was the, as much as anything else, the flavour, the mood, the rasa, the raga, if you like, of the whole lecture series, the spirit, if you like. We gained a very strong and vivid sense, I would say, of the golden light. Bhante says this of the golden light in that lecture series. He says, this golden light that transforms both self and world is a spiritual light, a transcendental light in the traditional sense of Lokuttara, that which is beyond the world, beyond the conditioned. It is a light without beginning and without end, a light which does not shine forth from anything, from anywhere, from any direction, although it might appear to do that. It is the light of truth, the light of reality, the light of the Buddha. So pure, incorruptible golden light, which is not of this world. That is what the Sutra of Golden Light evokes. It doesn't define it, it doesn't explain it, it doesn't conceptualize it. Rather, the Sutra of Golden Light just shows the effects of this golden light, its powerful, transforming effects on the individual and on the world, on all aspects of life. And you really felt it listening to Bhante, and you can still feel it listening to Bhante. I felt that he himself in some way was in touch with that light. Certainly you felt you were hearing, listening to somebody who certainly reverenced that light, looked up to that light. And he was sharing his reverence, his awareness of that light with us. So this series had a very big effect on order members back in those days. And one of these was Lokamitra. He says that listening to this lecture series was one of the main conditions, one of the reasons why he decided to move to India and start Dharma activities in Pune. He directly relates it to this lecture series on the Sutra of Golden Light. Because of my friendship with Lokamitra, my admiration for Lokamitra, he's one of my unofficial but very important Kalyana Mitras, I ended up going with him to India when we started things in Pune in the late 1970s. And then I went back again in the 80s. And that's how I ended up giving a talk in Goa beneath an image of Sarasvati. And I think I can also say that there is my own independent response to the Dharma. And that feeling that of the necessity, not only of living an individual Dharma life, but the desire, the very strong desire to want to make the Dharma known, to want to share my enthusiasm for the Dharma, to want to be involved in sparking others off in the Dharma, as I myself have been sparked off. I certainly can't say whether or not myself I'm in contact with the golden light, with the Subhana Basa. That would be quite a claim, a very big claim. But certainly meeting Sangharakshita, being ordained by Sangharakshita, being part of the Sangha he started, I have a sense of the tremendous vitality and energy of the Dharma. If you like, the lightning bolt quality of the Dharma. Whether I like that or not, sometimes I like it, sometimes I don't. In the space of a few minutes, I can go from liking it to really not liking it. But certainly it's clear through being in touch with that lightning bolt quality of the Dharma, the golden light of the Dharma, that life is for transformation. Whether I kind of like that transformation or not. transformation of self and transformation of world. So being in contact with the Dharma, one thing is very clear from these lectures on the Sutra of Golden Light, on the Golden Light itself. Being in contact with the Dharma is not about simply improving our worldly life. It's not, the Dharma is not, Buddhism is not, or maybe Buddhism is, but the Dharma isn't, about becoming a well-adjusted consumer, becoming well-adjusted to the norms of the world. It's not about that. When the Dharma gets into you, when a drop, a particle of the golden light gets inside you, it begins to work on you. You can't ignore it, even if you want to, even if you try to. It's in, and it just starts to kind of work on you. And everything in you which is foreign to that golden light starts to get affected, starts to get pushed out. So in the Sutra of Golden Light, the central chapter, the core of the whole sutra, is the chapter on confession. Confession, desana, papa desana, confession of evil, confession of faults, which I went into quite thoroughly in the last retreat we had on this. A confession that is made by the sound of a great golden drum being beaten by a Brahmin, who's more, Sangharakshita feels, a kind of shaman figure coming deep in the consciousness of a bodhisattva named Ruchiraketu. And it's an extremely thorough confession. It's a very deep confession. It's the Tibetans have a name for it, churning the depths of samsara. It's a real churning of the depths of samsara, that confession, which is the expression of the effect of the golden light of reality on the individual. It's the vomiting up, this confession, of everything that is the samsara in us. All of the roots of evil committed since beginninglessness. So it's really kind of confession more as an expression of insight, of wisdom. And, you know, sometimes there can be quite a lot of fascination, perhaps understandably, with insight and wisdom in the Buddhist community. But real vision and wisdom leads to this vomiting up of the roots of evil. It leads to confession. So this is what the golden light does, and it's very important to dwell upon that, to reflect upon the golden light. The golden light is not of this world. It's not of any other world either, just in case you get too literal about it. It's an entirely different dimension entirely. But the world these days, perhaps more than ever before, is very, very much with us. It's very strongly with us. And it's very, very easy, I think, for all of us, even some of us living in very good conditions indeed, to simply incorporate the Dharma into our worldly life, into our rather narrow and rigid sense of ourselves. It's very, very easy to do that. If it's the Dharma, if it's the golden light, it must be transforming. It must be vivid, not just vividly transforming, what's the word? You must be able to see the transformation. This is especially important for order members and those training for ordination. Recently I've been reflecting a bit more on what I want to sense in someone who wants to be ordained. This isn't a new criteria, by the way, for readiness for ordination, you'd be pleased to know. This is just my personal reflection on what I really want to see. And the first thing that came to my mind when I was thinking about this was something that Bhante said years and years and years ago about how you can tell whether or not somebody's ready for ordination. He said you should be able to see a reflection of a reflection of the transcendental. We all went, wow, yeah, of course. Well, begs all sorts of questions, doesn't it, about whether we can see a reflection of the reflection of the transcendental. But I think I can sort of feel what he means. If you like, what you want to see in someone, if they want to be ordained, is genuine Shraddha. a genuine resonance with that which is beyond. Of course, you can't prove this. You can't demonstrate it. That's why you can't call it a criteria. I wouldn't say to somebody, demonstrate to me your reflection of a reflection of the transcendental. That's appalling. I hope they'd give me a slap if I'd say that, metaphorical one, because we're not violent. This is more a matter, I think, for order members to sense that in somebody coming up for ordination. Certainly, you really want to see that reverence for what is beyond, that ability to revere, to really cherish and treasure that which is beyond the mundane, particularly in the form of the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas and the mystery, if you like, of the Dharma. You're certainly wanting to see that, feel that, sense that. But then out of that, you want to be able to see, well, are they in touch, somebody being ready for ordination, with what I've called the lineage of Kalyanamitrita? They're seeing that, if you like, transmission of the transcendental manifesting through Sangharakshita, yes, and his disciples. Are they in touch with people in the order who have that quality themselves? Can they see that being expressed within our Sangha, within our spiritual community? People love our Sangha. You know, they love the friendliness, but it's not just about friendliness. For a Sangha to be a Sangha, you need to feel that it's really in touch with that deeper dimension, with the golden light, at least to some extent. So you want to see whether somebody's in touch with the lineage of Kalyanamitrita, and then, out of that, do they have a hunger, a thirst, a passion for a vigorous spiritual regimen? Not simply they've got an effective practice. I'm getting a bit bored with this word effective and the word practice. But are they going out of their way to practice, to remove the obstacles between them and the Dharma? Is there a real hunger to meditate, to study, to improve and deepen their ethical practice, to engage in puja very fully and deeply? Is that really strongly alive for them? Is there that passion, that hunger, that desire, you know, to go deeply into the Dharma? And is there a real interest in others? A real interest in others' Dharma life? A real interest in taking the Dharma out to others? Is there dana, is there generosity to bring the Dharma into the world? And is there an intelligence, a practical Dharmic intelligence, an internalization, a nous, if you like, a sus, a sense of what they need to do, what they need to do next in order to, well, make the golden light manifest more fully, both in their own minds and also the conditions that they put themselves in. So yes, the golden light does need to be there for those training for ordination. And of course, if we say that about those training for order members, it's got to be really vividly, strongly alive in order members. And the golden light doesn't only bring about confession and self-transformation, it transformed the world. In fact, in Ruchira Ketu's dream, where the verses of confession are beaten out of the great golden drum of the Dharma, the verses begin like this. By the excellent drum of golden light, may the woes in the triple thousand world be extinguished, the woes in the evil states, the woes of poverty here in the world. And by this resounding of the sound of the drum, may all troubles in the world be extinguished. May all beings be without fear, may they be fearless. And by this resounding of the sound of the drum, may all beings touch Buddhahood. So the verses of confession follow, they go on and on, these aspirations. They follow these tremendous aspirations for the well-being and the removal of suffering of all beings, for the enlightenment of all beings. So the confession isn't just, as it were, personal. The confession is arising out of the force, you could say, of the bodhicitta, out of the golden light. Confession here is really the removal of everything which is in the way of practicing the Dharma, living the Dharma for the benefit of all beings. And I think I said in my talk last time on confession, it's very important to remember that when we practice, you know, confession in our chapter meetings, going for refuge groups, or if we just do that spontaneously, personally, with a spiritual friend. Confession isn't a kind of wallowing in our faults or in self-pity or anything like that. It's to remove that which is hindering the force of wisdom and compassion in the world. That's what we should be aspiring to, anyway. Confession is really getting ourselves out of the way so that the golden light can shine for the benefit of all. So in the first retreat on this Sutra of Golden Light, we looked at the opening chapters. We looked at this wonderful dream of the Bodhisattva. We looked at confession. And then we looked at, began to look at the transformation of the world by looking at the four great kings, the four Lokapalas, the four protectors of the world, who transform all of the powerful, chaotic, but really rich and sort of lovely energies of the samsara, and how they can come into and enrich our Dharma practice. And today, I want to move on and look at chapter 7 of the Sutra of Golden Light, in which the goddess Sarasvati comes to the Buddha in response to the sutra, the teaching of the Sutra of Golden Light. This is what she says. Well, this is how the chapter begins. Then indeed, Sarasvati, the great goddess, covered one shoulder with her robe, placed her right knee on the ground, made the gesture of reverence in the direction of the Lord Buddha, and spoke thus to him. I, dear Lord, the great goddess Sarasvati, will contribute eloquence for the sake of adorning the speech of the monk who expounds the Dharma. And I will bestow on him a dharani, that's a magic spell. I will bestow on him a dharani. I will arrange the substance of his speech so that it is well spoken. I will give great illumination of knowledge to the monk who expounds the Dharma. Whatever words or letters from this excellent golden light, King of Sutras, may have been lost or forgotten, I will supply this monk who expounds the Dharma with all these well-spoken words and letters, and I will bestow on him a dharani for the sake of preventing the loss of its memory, so that this excellent King of Sutras, the golden light, may long go forth in the world for the welfare of those beings who have planted merit roots under thousands of Buddhas, so that it may not soon disappear, so that numerous beings, having heard this golden light, King of Sutras, may have inconceivable acute wisdom, an inconceivable heap of knowledge, a long life and prosperity, help for living, unlimited merit, skilled in various means, learned in all textbooks, obtaining success in various arts. She also goes on to describe a ritual bath and a ritual worship, and Bhante feels that this part of the sutra is an undigested lump of ethnic religion, not fully incorporated into the Dharma. Never had a go at the... It's amazing. You've got to gather all sorts of herbs. And anyway, we won't go into that. What I want to concentrate on is really what Sarasvati says she will contribute, what she will give to the monk, the bhikshu, who expounds the Dharma. That's really the most important part of the chapter. And it's significant that Sarasvati is the first of the goddesses who responds to the golden light. She's the goddess, if you like, the patron in Indian culture of art, culture, learning, knowledge and teaching in the ordinary sense, and indeed in the higher cultural sense as well. She's really embodies very refined culture, and she plays the veena. I think Indian musicians probably refer to or worship Sarasvati. She plays this ancient Indian instrument, the veena. So this is the first thing that is responding to the golden light, or certainly the first of the goddesses that's responding to the golden light, to the man who expounds the golden light, to what's known as the Dharma Bhanaka. The Dharma Bhanaka. This is a very important figure in Mahayana Buddhism, the Dharma Bhanaka. Bhanaka meaning expounder. The expounder of the Dharma, the reciter of the Dharma, the proclaimer of the Dharma. The Dharma Bhanaka is highly esteemed in Mahayana Buddhism. They seem to have been these figures who would particularly recite and expound and proclaim and declare the different Mahayana sutras. There are even sutras that say that the Dharma Bhanaka should be regarded as the Buddha. You know, they're so cherished, so revered, because in this context they will be articulating the golden light, the transcendental golden light. Not just expounding it, but transmitting it in some way. Perhaps even channeling, communicating, unleashing that golden light. So the Dharma Bhanaka, the monk who expounds the Dharma, is extremely important to people. He's the sort of link between them and this pure golden light. So Dharma, and then Bhanaka, Dharma Bhanaka. So if we want the golden light to transform the world, we have to make sure that we give priority to the communication of the Dharma. I know this might seem obvious, but I think it's very important to just make that point. If we're thinking, if we're involved in Buddhist centres, involved in Dharma activity, the primary purpose of those places is to teach and communicate the Dharma in the fullest sense, in the fullest and deepest sense. I know that in Buddhist centres there are other things that are taught, and you know, meditation for relaxation and all these different things, which has a place. I don't want to undermine that. But the primary purpose of a Buddhist centre is to communicate the Dharma in the fullest sense, to bring people to the Dharma in the fullest sense, to transmit the golden light. Later on, as we'll see tomorrow, other goddesses come forward and they offer other things. They represent the transformation of other aspects of life. But Saraswati comes first, and I think she comes first because it's giving priority to the communication of the golden light of the Dharma in the fullest sense. In his lecture on Buddhism and culture, which is a wonderful lecture, I'm not going to try and reprise all of it, I'd recommend listening to all of it. He goes into some very important points, including the whole relationship between Buddhism and culture, and do you have to be a Buddhist and be into Eastern culture, which is a very important area. I can't go into all that, but in the lecture, Bhante essentializes what Saraswati says she will give to the Dharma Bhanaka, to the proclaimer of the Dharma. First of all, she will give eloquence. Secondly, she gives good memory. Thirdly, she arranges the substance of his speech so it is well spoken. Fourthly, she gives great illumination and knowledge. And fifthly, she gives a dharani. So I'm going to go through each of these. So you don't have to remember them all straight off. Go through each of these five things. I want to look at them as five essentials if you want to become an expounder, a proclaimer of the Dharma. You do sometimes hear people saying that they really want to teach the Dharma, and no doubt there's something very good in that. But if you want to, you have to develop these qualities. And I think it's important to think of becoming a communicator, a transmitter of the Dharma, not as a status thing, not as becoming a Buddhist teacher. I think that's not a good way to think. In fact, I don't like being described myself as a Buddhist teacher. I think teaching is an aspect of Kalyana Mitrata. It's not something separate. I certainly don't think we should be setting up a sort of status for people as Buddhist teachers. I don't think that's at all helpful. No, you really have to develop qualities if you're going to transmit and communicate the Dharma. But it is important to think in those days, in these terms. In the early days, Sangha Rakshita said all order members should be able to give 3 talks. You should be able to give, not incredibly complicated talks, but 3 talks. You should be able to give a talk on the Buddha and Buddhism. You should be able to give a talk on meditation. And a talk on a subject of the Dharma of your own choice. And he said that because, well, supposing you're at the centre and somebody wants to hear a Dharma talk, you know, the local Women's Institute, the local Working Men's Club, if we still have those things, the Rotary Club, a school, you know, wherever it may be, or somebody's ill and they can't do the class that night, you might be the only one available. You should be able to do a talk. Ready to give a talk. He said all order members should be able to do that. In the early days he had speakers classes, regular speakers classes. Arloka was describing the speakers classes he did in Norwich. He hired the assembly rooms, apparently, the whole assembly rooms, even though there were just a few of them. Bunty would sit at the back and you'd be up, the person giving the talk, whether they were order members or mitras, would be up behind a lectern at the front. And they'd talk, and the first thing Sangha Rakshita would often say, "I can't hear you." So he was really training them, and then would give them feedback. Arloka said he was much tougher on the senior order members than on others, and sometimes he'd give them spontaneous talks to give. And you can see what he was doing. He wanted to train people in the transmission of the Dharma, and well, I think we need to revive this this tradition of speakers classes. So yes, you need to be able to communicate the Dharma and do it well, because the Dharma, the golden light, is very, very precious. It's very, very special indeed. And if we want to communicate the Dharma, we'll need to develop the very best and highest in human culture in ourselves to be able to do that. You know, people can be put off by a poor Dharma talk. I mean, we do make mistakes. I've certainly put people off, I'm sure. I hope I'm not putting any of you off now, but it does happen, and you know, maybe we can't always be in control of that because of our personality and so on and so forth, you know. Anyway, but at least we can make the effort to develop the qualities to give a really good Dharma talk. And actually, I think if we're to do it really well, we need to be in touch with something almost divine, perhaps the blessings of the goddess, the Buddhist version of the goddess, Saraswati, not the Hindu one, Sankanath. If we wish to be an agent of the golden light, as we'll see, Sangha Rakshita believes that really Saraswati represents that aspect of the monk, the Dharmabhanaka, who teaches the Dharma, who represents the higher aspect of himself, if you like. So let's go through these 5. First off, eloquence. The word in Sanskrit is pratibhana, 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 eloquence. Pratibhana means making clear, making visible, making obvious, making brilliant. That's what you have to do in a Dharma talk. You make the Dharma clear, visible, obvious, brilliant. Pratibhana also means boldness and audacity. Boldness and audacity implies courage and readiness of speech, wit, that kind of quality. So if you want to communicate the Dharma, you need to be clear in your expression. You need to make the Dharma clear and obvious for people. So, and that means you need to clarify the way you communicate. So often these days you meet people and they're just not clear, even in talking about themselves. And well, themselves or a subject. You get so many, well, you know, maybe I kind of felt sort of kind of, and it was a bit kind of, you know, and I felt a little bit, and you think, where's the content? You know, I'm hearing all this feeling and all this sort of thing, but I'm not actually, there's no message here. I don't know if you've ever found that. I found myself switching off sometimes. So we need to learn how to give clear expression to our thoughts, to our emotions and feelings, to our knowledge. We need to make things plain and clear. If you can do that for yourself, it gives you much more confidence in yourself. You'll develop more clarity and confidence. Sometimes I think people aren't clear because they haven't sorted through, you know, the confusion within their own mind, within their own consciousness. And I think this is where friendship is very valuable. A good friend can help you clarify your thoughts and feelings and emotions. But we need to be able to do that with the Dharma. And this is what a good study group should be about, really helping people clarify what the Dharma is and the way they're thinking about the Dharma, the way they're responding to the Dharma. Certainly, I don't think anybody should really be allowed to give a Dharma talk, a public Dharma talk, if they cannot be clear and if they cannot make the Dharma plain and obvious. It might be, before you can give Dharma talks, yes, you do speaker's classes, or you do quite a lot of writing to clarify your thinking. Or, as I say, you run through it with a friend. Sometimes some of the community members here who are going out to, you know, give a Dharma talk or something like that, they'll come to me and say, I've been thinking of talking like this, of exploring things in this way. What do you think? You know, so I just get them. Very often it's just a matter of clarifying the way they're going to put it together, but I can also point them in directions to develop things. So I have to say, it's one of the things I love more than anything, I think, being helping people to clarify their thoughts about the Dharma, their response to the Dharma, they're interested in the Dharma, because they're actually going to be communicating the Dharma to others. It's something that fills me with, well, I feel it's the best use of me in many, many ways. But of course, we need to go further. Pratibhana, as I've said, means boldness, audacity. I love that word, audacity. We communicate the Dharma, in other words, creatively, imaginatively. And that's because of your deep feeling for and love for the Dharma. When Bhante talks about eloquence in his lecture, he says it's coming from real feeling for the Dharma. It's not being a highly polished after-dinner speaker on the Rotary Club circuit. It's not about that. It's about having a real love for what you're talking about. Saraswati says she will adorn the speech of the Dharma Bhanaka. One of Bhante's friends told him, when Bhante had been criticised for his flowery language when he wrote the Survey of Buddhism, somebody took it and said, it's too flowery, your exposition of the Dharma. And he told this to a friend, and this friend just said, that which you love, you adorn. That which you love, you adorn. So I think, you know, if you're being eloquent about the Dharma, you will adorn your presentation of the Dharma with really beautiful, lovely words. You'll overflow with words. You're with wonderful, beautiful words, with turns of phrase, figures of speech. You'll find the choicest words, the choicest figures of speech when you communicate the Dharma. Yes, there'll be clarity, but there'll be beauty as well. A great Dharma talk, I feel, a really great Dharma talk, great Dharma talks I've experienced, I've heard, they become like poetry. They become like a kind of invocation. Yes, there's great clarity. There's great practicality. There's things we can use. It clarifies things. But there's something else. There's a kind of invocation that goes on. You're transported. You sense the golden light to some extent coming through. And it's uncontrived. It's not natural. It's not a technique. It's not a trick of the speaker. It's coming out of their love for the Dharma. I can remember being in seminars sometimes with Bhante, and he'd just be talking about something. I remember on one occasion he was talking about green Tara in a seminar in the retreat centre lounge. That's where we used to have seminars in those days. And he was just talking about green Tara, and it was really strange. It was as if this green breeze just seemed to come through the room just for a moment, as if the words were taking some strange form, and then they just passed away as we moved on to something else. There was just this moment of transport because of his love of what he was talking about. So it's not a sort of performance, you know, giving the Dharma, the eloquence that goes with the Dharma. It comes out of our deep immersion in the Dharma, our love of the Dharma, our deep interest in it. And it doesn't have to be complicated. It doesn't have to be highly polished. I've heard Dharma talks given by Indian order members, Indian friends. I can't follow Marathi very well, but I could tell, and these were people who really weren't very well educated, I could tell that they were clear and they were delighting their audience. They were uplifting their audience with just very simple, very direct words. But the words were filled with, yes, love and yes, of clarity. So don't worry if you don't think you're a person who could do a great, long, complicated, fancy Dharma talk. That's not the point. Actually, it's much better if they're short and simple. Don't follow somebody like me who just goes on and on. Simple and clear and beautiful is best. Secondly, good memory. Good memory. This is what Sarasvati says she will give to the Dharmabhanaka. Memory, of course, is so important in ancient India, because for centuries and centuries it was all oral. It was all oral tradition. Nothing was written down. Dharma, culture, in all sorts of ways, was an oral tradition. This is, you know, such a thing to dwell on. A wise man was Bahushruta, one who has heard much. One who has heard much. Even after the emergence of texts, you would only really know those texts through having heard them. Through having heard them recited, chanted, and commented upon by the Dharmabhanaka, by your teacher. Tibetan masters, even today, they memorize, you know, the great master Dada Rinpoche would have memorized, you know, hundreds and hundreds, thousands of texts, so that they could be recited and expounded upon. And when Bhante was teaching Buddhists in India, but that's Dalit Buddhists, of course, from a Dalit background, many people present would have been illiterate or barely literate, because, you know, they denied education. So the Dharma Pravachan, the Dharma discourse, the Dharma talk, was a real occasion. That's why Dharma talks in India, I don't think it's the same these days. With you know, I don't think it's the same. Sankarnath will be able to tell us. But even when I was in India in the 80s, if you'd spoken for an hour and a half, people would look at you puzzled at such a short talk. You know, a good talk should last 3 hours. As you go on, and it shouldn't just be Dharma, but all sorts of cultural references, stories, all sorts of things coming across. It's a real cultural occasion. Nowadays, it's probably very different, and it's certainly different in the West as well. Memory, I don't think, is prized so much in these days of data storage. But memory is much, much more than simply the storing of information. Learning the Dharma, learning great literature, come to that, by heart, does something to us. Learning by heart, such a lovely idiom in English. Not learning by rote, learning by heart. Your heart learns. It does something to us when we learn by heart. It does something to our consciousness. It enriches us. We carry what is great within us when we learn by heart. We carry the Dharma within us. So if we want to communicate the Dharma, we need to be carrying the Dharma within our heart and have it readily available to us. Because you never know when you'll have to tell it. You'll never know. You never know when it will come up, when you get talking to somebody and they find out you're a Buddhist. And sometimes they want to know immediately, well, what does that mean? Tell me what the Dharma is. Well, it's very, very handy if you've got the Dharma present. Not just as a few vague ideas, but you could actually give a sort of teaching. So yes, I think we do need to be able to recall the great teachings. Memory, I know, is a very mysterious thing. Why do we remember what we remember? It's a problem as we get older, when we get those lapses in memory. But memory, I think, is connected with what really interests us. What we really love, actually. I could never remember what I needed to pass exams. I could never remember anything at school. Hated school. No amount of cajoling and the fear of God or whatever being put into me and haranguing could get me to learn anything at school. Nothing. I can't really remember anything from school. When I found the Dharma, I found that what I read, what I heard, just stuck. It just did. And it stuck because I loved it. Because I was passionately interested in it. I've never really had to learn a Buddhist list. Maybe one I had to do a bit of work at. They just went in. I don't quite know how that happened. They were just there. There are big lapses in my memory, important areas of life. Numbers, dates, forget it, unless it's to do with my personal finances. Interesting, isn't it? What a giveaway that is. But really, it's because I immediately loved what I encountered with the Dharma. Having said that, I think it is really good to learn the lists of the Dharma. I really do. I think the Dharma lists are so wonderful. They provide such an important structure for thinking and therefore for communicating the Dharma. I was recently asked, but what do we really need to know in Buddhism? There's all this stuff that keeps pouring out, you know, as if Sangharakshita isn't enough. There's Sabuti, there's Padmavajra, there's Satyaraja, all these different teachings that are coming out. What do we need to know? And I said, well, it's very simple. There's a wheel, there's a spiral, and there's a mandala. Or, if you like, there's a wheel, there's a path, there's a goal. And you can fill that up with all the different lists. That's the basic structure of Buddhist thinking. A wheel of life, a samsara, a path, and nirvana, all described in different ways. That's your basic structure. That's what you can put everything into. Well, that's a sort of list. It's just there. I can put anything into it. In India, when we went on tour especially, there was no question of making notes to give talks, and it was also helpful having a gap between each phrase with an interpreter. So, but I had within me lists, the great, I don't like the word list, the essentialized Dharma truths, you know, arranged in a coherent way. That's what they really are. They're crystallizations of the Buddha's teaching. And I had so many. They're like musical scales. That's what they became like. They're like the scales of a musician on which you can improvise, on which you can do all sorts of things with, depending on who you're with, depending on the particular mood and inspiration that you have. But you can just play endlessly with these wonderful scales, these wonderful lists of Dharma. Not just lists, but it's also important to memorize the stories and the imagery, the wonderful stories of the Buddha, the wonderful stories in the White Lotus Sutra. Sometimes I used to feel in India, well, often I used to feel, this is really more about being a storyteller. This is more about going from place to place, telling Dharma stories in a way that can really connect with people's lives. Stories I'd seen from the world around me, stories from the Dharma, stories from life, and then just pointing at a moral from that, drawing out a Dharma principle from that. So learn stories by heart. And you know, learning by heart is really the beginnings of wisdom. The first stage of wisdom is the wisdom that comes through hearing or learning. And they mean learning by heart. And then you have the wisdom that comes through reflection and thought. And then the learning that comes through experience. But it begins with learning the Dharma by heart. George Steiner, that brilliant cultural critic, literary critic, who was trained in the old French lycée system, where you were forced to learn by rote all the great, you know, French and Latin and Greek writers. He said it was awful, but actually he felt that it had really given him something. He said it gave him ballast in relation to the storms and stresses of life, having all that knowledge and wisdom inside him. Also, it means, of course, that you develop illumination when the Dharma gets inside you. You begin to see the truths that these teachings embody. So yes, I think, you know, really have a go at learning by heart. Doesn't have to be loads and loads, but just a few things. Maybe a Dhammapada verse or two. Get that in your consciousness and go into it deeply, and from that you can communicate the Dharma more deeply. I think if we don't get the Dharma by heart, how can we pass it on to others into the future? It's not just a matter of keeping it in data banks and in books and things like that. It's got to occupy our hearts, our consciousness. Thirdly, Sarasvati... Oh, goodness. Thirdly, Sarasvati... Dear. This goes on and on. Thirdly, Sarasvati promises to arrange the substance of the Dharma Barnaka's speech so that it is well spoken. And in his commentary on this, Bhante points out that the content of Mahayana sutras is often very difficult, very profound, but they're also arranged in a very unsystematic way. The Sutra of Golden Light is rather like that. It's a real rag bag, as he calls it, a transcendental rag bag, a kind of jungle. And as I said last night, you certainly felt like that. How is Sangha actually going to get 8 lectures out of this sutra? How is such a short, weird hodgepodge of a text, where there are just these weird things happening, and where there's this constant praise of the sutra? But Bhante, perhaps with the blessings of Sarasvati, saw the message of the Sutra of Golden Light and brought system and clarity to the sutra without destroying its power and majesty and mystery, its beauty. I think this is very important. Incredibly beautiful passages in the sutra, especially hymns and praises of the Buddha. I think Sangharakshita Bhante is a great exemplar of presenting the Dharma systematically. And if we want to communicate the Dharma, we need to be able to do that. This is made very explicit, actually, in the Pali Canon and also in various Mahayana sutras, which describe the way a Bodhisattva teaches. They say the Dharma should be presented systematically. There's a beginning, there's a middle, there's an end. And you show the practical, gradual steps of the path. And in this way, people listening can make sense of what you are saying. The Dharma will make sense to them. I must admit, I've just a few times, because people have told me, you know, to look up something, I've had a look at Buddhist, quite famous Buddhist teachers in the Buddhist world, not involved in the Tri Ratna. I've had a look at some of their talks, and I've been really shocked at how rambling and incoherent they are. These are talks by people who are regarded very, very highly, but rambling and incoherent, not at all systematic. Sometimes this is held up as spontaneity and direct experience. To me, it looks rather lazy and rather sloppy, and actually a betrayal of the Dharma, actually. So when we communicate the Dharma, make sure you really bring systematic attention to what you're communicating. Lay it out clearly for people. Fourthly, Saraswati promises to give the Dharmabhanika great illumination and knowledge. Obviously, if you're going to communicate the Dharma, you must know the Dharma. You know what the words mean. You know what the principles of the Dharma actually are. You know the ideas. Yes, you know you've got a good intellectual grasp. It doesn't, have to be an incredibly complicated grasp of things, but just a good, straightforward grasp of the trend of the Dharma. Too often, I think, these days, people kind of take refuge in their feelings about the Dharma, in their own personal experience, can be put forward rather prominently. Yes, it is good to reference personal experience, but it should be illustrating the Dharma. A Dharma talk should be full of content, Dharma teaching, illustrated with some personal experience. But more than a good understanding, more than a thorough understanding, there needs to be illumination. There needs to be something of the golden light coming through, or at the very least, reverence for the golden light of the Dharma, love of the golden light of the Dharma. Bhante puts it quite strongly in his lecture. When the Dharmabhanaka, the monk, speaks, it must be the golden light speaking. Otherwise, the sutra of the golden light is not truly preached. And he adds, at this point, Saraswati does not represent any merely external agency, because no external agency can give illumination and knowledge. Saraswati really represent the monk's own cultured, cultivated consciousness. Saraswati represents the refined, the powerful emotions associated with that consciousness, emotions which have become integrated with the spiritual life and which therefore contribute to the realization of the transcendental, the realization of the golden light. It's a tremendously important passage. Saraswati embodies the arts, culture at the highest level. It's that very refined, powerful consciousness and the emotions associated with it. And we notice, you know, if you look at Buddhist tradition, so many of the great Buddhist teachers, from the Buddha onwards, actually, are poets, artists, musicians, even. Buddhist monasteries were not just centres of meditation and study, they were centres of culture. And the Dharma was expressed through so many cultural forms of great beauty. I was thinking for some reason about Dujon Rinpoche in this respect, reading a particular song, a feast song that he composed when he was 19. And I don't know what the Tibetan sounds like, but even in the English translation, there's this tremendous, tremendous art and beauty brought to this poem, this invocation, this longing invocation to Padmasambhava on the glorious copper-coloured mountain. And, you know, apparently he was somebody with an enormously refined Tibetan language and skills and so on. So this is a great yogi, a great master, being able to speak in that way, to communicate the Dharma through this great beauty. So if we want to communicate the Dharma, yes, we can cultivate that consciousness, that sensibility. Not necessarily through engagement with Eastern forms. It probably won't be like that for us. Most of us here, I think, are Western Buddhists, so we're in a strange sort of position. We inherit a traditional Buddhist form from a different culture, but we're practicing and communicating the Dharma in a different world, a world which is sort of, you know, becoming, you know, spreading all over the place. I mean, this room with all the paintings, you might be thinking, well, these are all Eastern forms. But although the iconography comes from these, Aloka insists these are nothing like Eastern Buddhist forms. He said Eastern Buddhist artists would be probably quite shocked at what they would be seeing in here. It's an engagement of a Western sensibility with the iconography of Buddhist tradition. When I was thinking about this, I was thinking of a really interesting correspondence between Sangharakshita and Lama Govinda, Lama Anagarika Govinda, which took place towards the end of Lama Govinda's life. And these letters were published in an old FWBO newsletter, which you can find in our library. And Bhante was writing to Lama Govinda about how he was spending the autumns, the autumn months in Italy, leading the ordination course that we had in a convent, an old convent in Italy, in Tuscany, and how he would look at the art of the Italian Renaissance. And this is what Sangharakshita says towards the end of one letter. He says to Lama Govinda, "As a Buddhist, I feel no inclination whatever to neglect Europe's vast treasure store of culture. On the contrary, in fact." And Lama Govinda's reply to this bit of the letter is very interesting. He says, "Like you, I always uphold the importance of European culture. Without knowing the root of our own culture, how can we absorb the essence of Buddhist culture?" Very interesting exchange. But better move on. Sorry, it's going to be a late lunch today. Not far to go. Sarasvati promises to bestow on the Dharmavarnaka a dharani, a magic spell. That's what a dharani is. Something to bear in mind. It's sort of like a mantra. This is a feature of Mahayana sutras that deities will give to a bodhisattva, this protective spell to support them in their Dharma work. Bhante feels that what's going on here, there is a touch of the Vajrayana, which is very concerned with sort of magical transformation coming into the sutra. And he says, well, the Dharmavarnaka, it indicates the fact that the Dharmavarnaka needs in his work of communicating the Dharma a special quality, something magical, something, and I'm quoting Sangharakshita here, transcendentally charismatic. His words, transcendentally charismatic. He needs to be a kind of Padmasambhava figure. Otherwise, it's very difficult to succeed in his work. He then adds, this is a very important topic, but there's no time to go into it now. And I don't have time to go into it now, so if you want to follow that up, you can. So those are the five things that Sarasvati promises to give the monk who expounds the Dharma, who expounds the golden light. Eloquence, good memory, arranging the words into a well-spoken system, great illumination and knowledge, and the dharani, the magic spell. It's a really interesting set, I think. And as I've said, anybody serious about communicating the Dharma, in fact, living the Dharma, and we're all communicating the Dharma, whether or not we're giving formal talks. We're communicating the Dharma when we're in study groups, when we're talking about the Dharma to one another, when we're in a reporting in, when we're with friends. So I think this list is important in relation to all of that. The last part of the chapter on Sarasvati has some really beautiful praises by somebody called Kondinya, praises to Sarasvati. But at the end of his lecture, although he reads those beautiful praises, at the end of his lecture, Bhante prefers to invoke the fully Buddhist bodhisattva of wisdom, learning and culture, and the arts and sciences, Manjugosha, the sweet-voiced Manjushri, the gentle radiance, who is incidentally, the patron of Buddhist monasteries, and he, which, as I've said, are centres of learning, culture and wisdom. And well, there's Manjugosha, Manjushri, there, overlooking the room. And I want to end by just reading the last part of Sangharakshita's lecture to you. It won't take long. The whole question of Buddhism and culture is a very important one. Culture occupies a very important place in our lives and spiritual development. At the beginning of the lecture, I mentioned the Sarasvati Puja in India, and I couldn't help wishing that we could have in this country a Sarasvati Puja of our own, a puja of celebration and festivity that would symbolise for us the integration of cultural activity into the spiritual life. How wonderful that would be. I just should just say here that there was recent Order Weekend at Adistana, which actually fulfils this. I wasn't there, unfortunately, but it was a real celebration of the arts in our order, and by all accounts it was a really, really wonderful and uplifting weekend. So this is really lovely that it's been fulfilled, and maybe Lokeshwara, the order convener, maybe we should do it every year, have our own Saraswati Puja like that, something like that anyway. But then Bhante says, even better would be a Manjugosha Puja. Saraswati really represents Indian culture, but Manjugosha is more universal. He's found all over the Mahayana Buddhist world, and he could perhaps come west. Manjugosha symbolises the profoundest wisdom, transcendental wisdom expressed in the most highly developed and most refined culture. He's usually depicted as a beautiful young prince, golden yellow in colour, and he sits cross-legged on a blue lotus throne. He wears a crown and headdress of 5 full-blown lotus flowers. In his right hand, which is raised aloft, he wields a flaming sword of wisdom, and in his left hand a book, which he holds against his heart. His expression is compassionate and smiling, and the whole figure radiates brilliant golden light. In the person of Manjugosha, culture has been fully assimilated. Culture has been fully absorbed. Culture is the ornaments that sparkle on the golden body of Manjugosha. Ultimately, the golden light transcends culture.